views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the views or endorsement of any entity. Nothing being said on this podcast should be considered as investment advice.
Welcome, y'all. Welcome. We have an amazing show today. This is 100 Proof. I am not Kevin Rose. I am Amanda, aka Stevie. And we're going to have an amazing show. Kevin and Derek are off today. And so I'm calling it the kids table. You know, we got some local DJs here from our team. And we've got a special, very special guest. I'll get to her in a second. But welcome, y'all. This is 100 Proof. Let's get started, y'all. We've got Sam, aka NFT Stats. He is the director of research here at Proof. What's going on, Sam?
What's up, Amanda? I'm pumped to have Word Daddy here. First time for him, and I'm always excited to see Carly. She's such a great commentator, and it's great to have her on the show.
Yeah, man, I'm so excited, and I know you're still here in Wisconsin. We saw a couple pictures of you and Grant Yoon and Tyler. You all had a little meetup that was so cute, having a very typical Wisconsin summer day. That was really cute.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Milwaukee. Grant lives in Milwaukee. You know, we have a house here, so. Yeah, that had to happen. And then it kind of occurred to me that I could reach out to Chicago people. So, yeah, we got Tyler Grant together and had a nice episode. Yeah, it was fun.
I love a good IRL meetup. All right. We've also got Dalton. This is his first time. Dalton, a.k.a. War Daddy Capital. He is one of our NFT researchers here at Proof. He's just a big brain. We're just happy to have you here, man. Welcome.
GM. No, I'm super excited to be here. This is awesome. First time for me. So let's go.
Let's go. Don't mess it up. And then our very, very special guest, Carly Riley from Overpriced JPEGs. Welcome. It's so good to see you. Hello.
Thank you. It is so good to be back. My favorite show other than Overpriced JPEGs.
Same.
I also get all of my NFT information from Sam. So it's going to be really fun to parrot all of his own talking points right back at him. This is going to be a good time.
Yeah. I think this should be a nice little like alpha session. You know, we don't, maybe not have alpha, but I think we can give each other some really good takes. And I think it's going to be really, really fun. I'm stoked to have
alpha,
you here.
I would be on a beach somewhere. I would not be sitting here with the three of you. Let me be clear.
Fair point.
It's kind of funny because anytime I'm listening to Carly and I disagree with her, I'll like text her, be like, hey, I don't really agree with that. And she'll do the same with me. So we normally just settle our disputes over DM. But
texted me before when I'm watching him on my phone and I'll be watching Sam and then I'll get a little like Sam text pop up like as an overlay on his face. It's great.
Double Sam. I love it. Yeah. All right. So what are we going to talk about today? You know, when we were thinking about the show topics, I think the thing that kind of kept going on over and over again was, you know, this is kind of a tough market. You know, we know ETH kind of rallied, Bitcoin rallied over the last couple of days. People are euphoric. Everything that happened with XRP, people are incredibly euphoric over there. But what does it do to an NFT market, right? Like, and what do you do when we're still clearly in a bear, clearly in a tough market? There are still some like little glimmers of hope here. And I do think that this is the time that it really kind of gets really exciting, in my opinion. Like, this is where people start looking to either make statements, to go full conviction, to look over rocks and look under rocks and find something you know, incredible. And I think this is a really fun time. So let's get started. Like, let's see. One of the things. Oh, you know what? I apologize. I just wanted to jump right in, but I wanted to give everyone. Let me give everyone an overview of the whole day. So we're gonna go with what's going on in NFT market and how tough that is. And then we're also going to talk about our thoughts on Threads and if that's even a thing anymore. Some people are saying it's not, but we'll see. We'll see. And then we've got the latest Mythics Chronicles video as well. So that should be a really fun premiere. And towards the end of the show, we're going to have an artist spotlight with OSF. That's when Sam spoke with him to talk about the state of the space, you know, his background. He's a big trader, made some really historic trades over the last few months. I want to hear all about that. And he's also, you know, the creator of Wrecked Guy and other, you know, incredible pieces of art. So want to hear all about that journey. And then again, as a reminder, follow us on Proof Podcast on Twitter for the latest content from Proof. And then if you're watching here on Spaces, bless you, because we don't have very many listeners. Bless you. And I think it's because everyone wants to come live on YouTube. So if you are listening on Spaces, thank you so much. But we all know the action is here on YouTube. You get to watch me stammer and not read the prompter well. So let's go. All right, let's get back into it. Story one. What do people focus on in a tough market? You know, one of the things that we've been talking about over the last few months is ordinals. And we know, Carly, that you are really at least intrigued by ordinals. What do you think that maybe is going on in the market that has forced people to dig a little deeper and go into something like the ordinals?
Well, I think first, ordinals is fun right now, and there's not a lot of fun to find in NFTs. Like, there are actually people making money over there, and if we're all honest, we know that's why anybody's here in DeGen land. So yes. I think it's partly that. I also think that most people who've been paying attention to the space over the last 2 years have learned that art is probably a good bet to make, better than a lot of the other bets you can make. Y'all at Proof were in on that probably earlier than the rest of us, but art's a really smart bet and a really good use case for NFTs. And what Bitcoin is a great store of value chain. Mm-hmm. So combining like the Cadillac store of value chain, the most decentralized, the one that everyone in the mainstream thinks of when they think of crypto, like it has a lot of things working to its advantage when you're just thinking about it as a store of value. And art pairs really well with that, where I'm not seeing Bitcoin and other people are, like, I'm not looking at ordinals for like the next PFP meta on ordinals. I'm thinking about it as a really cool chain to store really fine art, and that pairing makes total sense to me. And there's been advancements recently, like some things with recursion, which on-chain monkeys did, like the first recursive project on ordinals. I don't know if I'm getting all that, if I phrased that right, but and so there's the potential for really cool art to come out on Bitcoin now, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, that's exactly where I am at too. I've yet to buy anything, you know, directly on Bitcoin. I think Coldy dropped something on like Emblem mm-hmm. Vault, and but that was just like I just paid with ETH, but somehow technically it's Bitcoin. So I don't have anything, you know, fully Bitcoin yet, but I'm waiting definitely for, you know, a low supply, you know, incredible piece of art, hopefully generative art. So hopefully using like recursions and all of those things. Like, I do think that there is something to be said there. Yeah.
The problem is with everything priced in BTC. Like I look at something and I'm like, oh, I can afford that. Oh no, it's Bitcoin, not ETH. I can't afford any of this.
Yeah. You're like 0.05. Oh, that's cheap.
Yeah, like, great. Done. Let's do it. Yeah, exactly right. I did briefly consider just pivoting my entire life to trying to get a Taproots Wizard whitelist, like allow list spot. I never really went hard on allow list in ETH. And I was like, you know what? Nothing else is going on. Like, maybe this is just my future. Like, I'll just do everything I can to try and get on the Taproots Wizards allow list and print like $60,000 in a day.
I'm sure they would have loved to see you in a shower video. Like, that would have been amazing. Is it?
I know that's already closed. Their next quest is apparently launching soon, quest number 4 or something. So I don't know. Depending on what it is, I you may see me out there doing ridiculous things on social media to grind
amazing.
That allow list. But
I actually have a friend who did a crazy job, because he said that he was going to use the money to pay for his wedding, and that was like the only way that his wife would, like, you know, her fiance would like let him still do all this degen stuff. So he was like, I'm going to go super hard, and Udi like loved it. He shared it, and so I'm pretty sure he's going to get one. And I'm like, dude, that was completely worth it, right?
I'm getting married in a month. That's my goal. This is, yeah, I'm like, please, right? I just need Taproot's Wizards to pay for the wedding. Sorry, Dalton, go ahead.
No, so I do have a quick question about this. So in the last 30 days, Bitcoin ordinals have done $142 million in volume. And that's just in the last 30 days. So that's doubling Solana, which was previously like the second biggest NFT ecosystem. I don't necessarily understand the draw to that. So what you're talking about with fine art, I think is like is a valid point, right? But if you look at the last 30 days, you have buyers, sellers, and volume trending down, but the average price per sale is trending up over the last 3 months. So like, it kind of plays to your point here of saying like, okay, fine art, there is a use case there to be had, right? But as for like PFPs, Taproot Wizards, we know those are going to be going for 40, 50, 60K at some point, right? But outside of that, like, I don't really see the point, right?
Yeah.
I think there's tremendous appeal. Bitcoin has tremendous appeal. To an extent, everybody who's here is, as in Web3, is drawn to technological novelty, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's something about the idea of the blockchain that's intriguing. And art on Bitcoin, and to be clear, this is not just art. We're not talking about putting snippets of code on Bitcoin. People are making games on Bitcoin. Like, this has implications far beyond art. Personally, I find the art piece exciting and interesting, but this is bigger than that. And so if you're already a tech nerd who likes to gamble, like, this is kind of a holy grail. And I get why for some people it's so exciting. Now, of course, Magic Eden jumped in quickly. So a lot of Solana people have gone there because they were struggling a little bit, I think, with just Solana being down so much. So I get it. I get why people are super stoked about this.
Yeah, I mean, on a tech standpoint, I'm not sure, but I do think that the fact that it is Bitcoin, and you know, people thought that it would go to $1 million already. You know, like, there's people who have these deep, deep bets into like the future of Bitcoin. So like, to get in early, even if it just means like you're holding it and nothing happens to it, now you just have exposure to Bitcoin in the same way that we have exposure to ETH, like, makes sense.
Which is to say nothing of the fact that Bitcoin may be the only crypto to come out unscathed.
Yeah.
In the United States. Now, the recent XRP news, that might not be true. I'm optimistic-ish, but you know, Bitcoin is not in the crosshairs of regulators, and it's the only one you can say that about.
That's true. What do you think, Dalton?
Very true.
Yeah, right?
I think that in the beginning, they were lacking a lot of the infrastructural pieces that I think are necessary for an NFT market or NFT ecosystem to explode. Now, with Magic Eden hopping in, with some of these different marketplaces that are taking over, I think the rare Satoshis and some of these big name projects with big name influencers that are getting involved, that is only going to push the space forward, right? And so I think it's an essential piece that we are starting to see. Now, we'll see what happens, right?
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I think that it is again, it's just a state of the market. You know, like you said, Carly, people are bored. People are bored. People want money. And it makes a lot of sense that they're kind of going towards that. And I think kind of on the opposite side, right, like, you see people jumping into different trends because it hopefully will make them money. Because I think that's just what you do when there's nothing happening maybe on ETH. On the other end of it, you're seeing people really kind of be a little bit more bold in some of the things that they're doing because they know that there's not that much going on in the market, right? So one of the things that really kind of excited me was Pudgy Penguins buying a noun, right? This is, you know, project supporting projects. Like, I think it makes a lot of sense to share this attention economy and use what you have and use the people who are still here, who are still engaged, and maybe start a whole new meta or attract new people who are still here. And so I know that Carly, I think you know Luca pretty well, and you know about Pudgy Penguins. What do you think about this idea?
Love it. Across right? the board, I love it. I what's been so interesting is to watch what feels like Luca's keen sense of how to enter the physical collectibles market. Like, it's been so interesting to watch how he has, on the one hand, done like mass market collectibles in the form of, you know, the drop they did on Amazon. And was it Macy's or Amazon?
Amazon.
It was mm-hmm. on Amazon. Yeah. Be Friends was Macy's. And you have that, like, more onboarding, more like an onboarding approach. And then he's done these
low number, high cost, like with network, mm-hmm. these physical drops that are much more appealing to like a high-end collector, mm-hmm. where the game is so much about managing supply and demand. And so far, I think he's walked that walk really well. And yeah. then something like this, it brings it together, where you're totally speaking to the NFT fans. You're working with one of the most respected names in NFTs. I think Nouns just across the board is so universally respected in terms of what they have done, in terms of the fundamental ethos and mission. And so bringing these two projects together, I think is great. And to see projects working with one another during this tough time, I think is exactly what we want to be seeing.
Exactly.
Collaboration and yeah.
Exactly. I completely agree. So big ups to Luca. It's a great idea. And I'm looking here on the proposal page on Nouns DAO, and they're almost, I think they're going to get approved. They've got, you know, 158-4 and 56 against. You know, I think Nouns DAO has been historically a very kind of hard DAO to get approved for, and the fact that this is causing so many waves that we've got so many for, I think is a good sign. So props to them. And I think that it, again, you know, here's another sort of kind of connection to this. I think, and again, in a tough market, you want to look for new and interesting markets to explore. So again, Luca went to Amazon, he went to Nouns DAO, he's doing a lot of things. One of the bigger news that happened yesterday was Bored Apes announcing Ape Fest in Hong Kong. There is a perfect example of, you know, we know there's some people who may be down bad, may not be able to, you know, afford, you know, a big trip to somewhere in America. Let's go for this newer market of people who are just starting to get really interested into NFTs. This is also where Animoca is, right? And so it makes a lot of sense. Sam, you lived in Hong Kong for many years. What do you think about this news?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned Animoca. I mean, obviously Captains is there, but I also think that there's, yeah. when I look at who the big buyers are, and it's hard to know who buyers are in this space because there's anonymity and whatnot, but it just feels like so many of the big NFT buyers are based in Asia right now. You know, I mean, Pimp Capital went and wrote Bored Ape Yacht Club in Chinese yesterday on his feed. He wrote it in traditional Chinese, not simplified, which is what they speak in China. He wrote in, or not speak, but what they, the characters they use. He used characters that are only really used in Hong Kong and Taiwan. I'm not sure where he's based, but that felt like it was not something that ChatGPT would have given him and felt authentic. I mean, Adrian Chung, who's a big real estate developer in Hong Kong, owns 101 Azukis and a bunch of Grails. And just, you can kind of go through a list of a lot of the big NFT buyers, and so many are based in Asia. And I think that Bored Apes are just kind of acknowledging that there's something about this product that is resonating with some of those markets right now. And Hong Kong has been pretty has made signs and shown signals that they plan to be very crypto friendly in a time where the U.S. is being less crypto friendly. So I think it's an interesting bet by them, and you know, I think it, you know, at the risk of a lot of the kind of, I still feel like probably a majority, I'm not sure about this, I'm actually just kind of guessing here, but I guess that maybe a majority of Bored Ape holders are based in North America. So at the risk of a lot of people who've kind of historically been with you not being able to attend, I still think that this, you know, for this year is a good move and an interesting kind of signal from them.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of people just super excited. A lot of people saying that they were going to get, you know, flights or that they had booked flights. There were some people you could tell who were salty. I, you know, props to the Bored Apes team for softening that blow with the Mutant Ape meetup, the Fuck It Saturday in Miami. That was the first one that they did, and then they dropped Hong Kong. I was like, ah, oh, that's brilliant. That's a brilliant marketing move and comms move, because you can't get that mad when, you know, they're going to allow all the mutants to come to Miami, and that should be a vibe. Like, so that was a great move.
I think we're running low on time here, but my thought on this is it's also savvy, because that's the market that everybody wants to be entering, yeah. right? So if they can throw a good party in Hong Kong and you know, there's people there locally in crypto or whatever else that think it looks awesome, like I think it's trying to signal to a market that, as Sam said, appears to be trying to plant a flag as
a crypto and Web3 hub, mm-hmm. which is always so interesting given the dynamic with China and but that's another conversation for another day, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, I lived in Hong Kong for 15 years. We left about 2 years ago, but all my kids were born there. You know, I have in-laws from there and stuff like that, and so many good friends there. And one thing that was always true was like luxury retail wanted to be in Hong Kong. You had all these luxury mm-hmm. stores saying their store, all these luxury brands, you know, the Louis Vuittons and Hermes, all those brands saying like their best performing store in the world was at the IFC, which is the biggest mall or the mall kind of right in central Hong Kong. And I don't, you know, and it's not just Hong Kong, it's really access to the China market. But there's something about this consumer that I think some of these status symbols, you know, which I think is the most proven use case for NFTs thus far, is NFTs as a flex, as a status symbol, like you own the grails. And that's kind of, it's a way to show off wealth. It's a way to be part of the community. It's just, I see some overlap there with kind of the luxury fashion world's real focus on that region, as well as like NFT projects being like, wait a second, like a lot of our biggest buyers happen to be coming from there and seem to want to flex our NFTs a lot. And I do feel like we're starting to see that kind of play out in business models a little bit more here.
Yeah, agreed.
And the character IP world. Now, I think Japan's even bigger for that. But like when you think about the character IP world having such a hub and so many of the origins coming from Asia.
Yeah. No, I mean, anime and they're like, it is always wild to me that I see so much like anime in this space. I'm like, who's buying all this anime? Like I didn't grow up with anime. And it turns out that there are a lot of people who have a lot more money than I do who love this stuff. And I think it's kind of all intertwined.
Yeah, apparently like Zoomers love anime. It's like the biggest thing. So it makes a lot of sense. We wouldn't know anything about it. All right, thank you all.
It could be that I'm older. It could be that I grew up in Wisconsin. So I'll leave that for the audience.
Maybe that. Hey, Dalton, you like anime? Little Zoomer? You like
no.
it?
No, that's not for me. I'm sorry, guys. Let's go.
But maybe you'll like Mythics. I know you do like Mythics. So let's without further ado, let's switch things over to the premiere of the Mythics Chronicles today. It should be a really, really great episode. So take a look at that.
Do you remember back in the day where somebody found the IP or the trademark, whatever we filed for Ravens. And this is when it was like paid off just to be as mysterious as humanly possible. And like, we know we want to do a next collection, but like, we hadn't really even figured out, like, is there a story?
I've been an artist my whole life, I think since about 5 years old. I kind of had a dream to go work at Lucasfilm. That was like a big goal of mine for a long time.
These two are the crew rewards that I got from working on Star Wars Rebels.
Achieved that and kind of was at a what's next phase. Long story short, I realized I wanted to hang my hat with Proof, and I like the integrity there, and here I am.
Mythics, anyone?
So this file is called Talon's Sketches. We didn't have any idea this was going to be called Mythics. This guy has an axe and he has a blood splat at his feet. He's kind of cute, but he also looks like a maniac. Or this punk bird right here, he's got spray paint. He's got the studded bracelet. He's got a little anarchy thing behind him. Or the one to the right here is like, oh, it's like a Chromie Squiggle bird. He's got the Chromie Squiggle shirt. But at some point when we realized they're the ancestors of the Moonbirds.
And I remember Luke being the one to ask about that as we're like kind of sketching Ravens, and you know, Luke has a ton of sketches and I love the style. They look so cool. They looked magical. And we were looking at a lot of old Disney art, like back at the Robin Hood era of it.
This is a wonderful Kitsune mask. And then you have a Jaguar God mask by Melita Kerfey, who is a great mask sculptor known as Miss Monster Mel.
Ravens that were like purely magical, some that looked like more tribal and had like old things, some that looked like super futuristic with like beaks and heads separating and gears and stuff like that. And if people are going to the Mythics exhibition that we're showing, we're gonna track the whole process from like, you know, Ravens all the way to like how we ended up at Mythics. We realized none of us had like a real opinion about like why it was what was gonna be cool. Is there a story here? Are we firmly saying there is no story? If the only reason we're telling a story is because we just need a story, all it really is window dressing.
This little crocodile skull is something I picked up off of Etsy, and I painted it to make it
sort of interesting and decorative, and that is a work in progress, a multi-year work in progress.
Luke and Colin both flew out to Santa Monica, that's where we were at the time, and we locked ourselves in this room where we had this whiteboard, and we basically just started trying to map everything. What if it's a story about the space that we're in right now? And so that was what set into motion this idea of the Erg Tree, which was like, there's a life you can live that it's not a bad life, but there's a comfortable life that you can have. But the Erg Tree is also like not reaching for something. And so to us, like the Erg Tree became this really amazing representation of possibility that's been bound, but it's ready to be cracked open.
These objects, when they become the charged objects, obviously these are all examples of that, right? When you understand why those are important to you and what yours are, and then as an artist, you want to make something that someone else makes into the charged object, and you don't do that all for them. I mean, the biggest honor for an artist would be you make something and someone else feels that way about it, and they put it on their wall, you know?
Yeah. I started to think, oh my God, I like this story. I love this story. I'm feeling really strongly about it. Oh no. What if nobody cares about this on the team? My fear was that there were 30 or now 40 people who had to understand this, and that was an entire campaign. Having come from games, a lot of times there's a debate very early on about whether people want to hear any story at all. And I think, of course we do. That's how we form communities. The charged object, you know, it's not like necessarily that thing's intrinsic value, but it's the story we put on it. And the fact that we've all spread it to the team and we all know it and care about it is, I think it's special.
I know people have said, why a collection now? Like, this is like the deep dredges of the bear market. What if there's not the demand? What if people aren't ready right now? This is the wrong time to do it. There's no better time. When is good enough? And right now for us, this story feels like not just the perfect story for us as creators, it feels like the right time to do it. To dig into our greatest fears, to talk about the things that stop us from becoming those things that we know we could become. And so Mythics is, it's deeply personal, but I hope it's really universal.
This little popcorn thing is, you know, Lily saw this, my wife saw this, and she said, oh, that's pretty, let's put it in the house. And I'm like, no way. You know, this stuff on here is like meaningful, it's the shrine. And we had a disagreement on this little popcorn jar. And now I remember that moment in the relationship and getting past that moment and learning to lighten up and accept, you know, that something that she thought was fun could sit next to all my like my magical crap. Maybe it is art, but it has the meaning, even though it's a very simple object. So
we'll put it back on the table.
Yeah, it's going back on the table.
I know what this storyboard is for.
Yeah.
Audience has not seen this yet.
I love seeing what that became.
Amazing. Oh, man. That moment with Justin, that got me. Great job, Mal, once again, on these amazing Chronicles videos. I was just checking in on the YouTube comments, and a lot of people are excited for the Mythics exhibition to be able to see all of that stuff live, which is going to be really, really fun. We are going to have a Mythics celebration on the 21st. At Foundry in downtown Los Angeles, where we'll have all of that awesome art on display for you all to check out. So I think it should be really fun.
I'm obsessed with that theme music. Can I just say?
I know, it's so good. It's so good.
I love that theme music so much. It just fills my heart with this sense of like, I'm in another world and I'm at peace. And it's epic.
Okay, I'm sure Mal will be happy about that.
Luke and Colin both are such great guys. Like the way that they can kind of portray all of that. And they're just like, I don't know. There's something about their energy that I just am absolutely fascinated with. And the way that they have been able to tell this story is just, like you said, I love Mythics. And I was like very hesitant about getting involved with NFTs at all. I've been very, you know, standing back in the market. But there's just something about this story that it hits home. And I'm excited for everybody to see what's going on.
Even the Zoomer is into it. I love it. He was in checking out checking out our Slack and seeing some of the previews. And I think one day he just finally was like, I got to get an egg. I got to do it. So I love to see it. People are really excited and we're excited. Yesterday we announced, you know, the start of the Tubin's run. We're just having more fun, you know, more fun. Why not? You know, because this is a bear market. What else are you going to do? But try to engage people and get them excited. And so we have the Tubin's run. It is like a worm NFT fork. And I think it should be really fun when you transfer it. It mints a little Tubin's charm. It is soulbound to your wallet. It's a lot of fun. So we're going to be kicking that off later today, actually. That's a little alpha. A lot of people have been bugging me about that. So it's going to go very, very shortly soon. And I'm really, really excited to see, you know, where Tubin's ends up. So it should be fun. All right, let's kick it off to the story number two, which is Threads. You know, is NFT Twitter going to Threads? I don't know, man. We got a couple of interesting, you know, data points that maybe might point to not, in that CNBC reports that Threads had its daily users down 20% since Saturday, and the user time spent on the platform is down 50%. So even though they gained 100 million users in 5 days, no one's fucking with Threads. No one's fucking with Threads. Are you? who's on it?
I'm on it.
Yeah.
My big thing, the reason I don't think NFT Twitter is going there necessarily is for me, and I think this is true of other people, though I'd be curious y'all's answers on this. Like, my Instagram world and my Twitter world are very different. Like, my Twitter world is where my crypto NFT world lives. That's not true for Instagram. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like it's a big lift to actually make Threads look like my NFT Twitter world, because it's so much easier, obviously, to just follow and find people who you're already following on Instagram. But that's a totally different world for me. And I think that's true for a lot of NFT people. I don't know. I'd be curious for y'all.
There's absolutely zero chance that I'm pivoting to Threads. I've been in crypto since 2017, and like to have like my Twitter world and my Instagram world are completely separate. I don't like
totally different.
My IG friends do not know that I even work in crypto because they would absolutely bash me.
Your IG is all thirst straps. So that won't work. That won't work.
That's what I do. And so I'm like, to have, and like you said, it is a heavy lift. And then I think the move from Elon to like start kind of incentivizing users to get impressions. Now, I think that we're going, Twitter already has like the copy pasta shit posting. Like, that is the Twitter world. I think we're incentivizing kind of bad behavior with paying these people, because I'm interested to kind of hear what you guys think about, like, now we're going to be putting out, or not we, but like, there's going to be false information that is like clickbaity that we have had, but it's almost been like as a joke. Now mm-hmm. I think people are incentivized to kind of put like these, like, oh my God, that's happening. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
I don't really like that.
Screenshot meta is coming right back. Sam, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, those are two separate things, but I guess there's some tie together. I think people, when you see something like, is this the Twitter killer? Is this the Facebook killer? I mean, it is so hard to beat a marketplace that basically has a monopoly on what they do, you mm-hmm. know, and it cannot be done in one day. It is very hard to do it in 1 year. It's just marketplaces, you know, where people have habits formed, have a network embedded in it. You can't just come and beat it. You know, that's just not how this industry has ever worked. That's why Facebook has been a good stock throughout, even though they've kind of declined our usage of Facebook. Like, it's been a 20-year company that's still one of the most valuable wow. companies in the world. Google is one of the most valuable companies in the world. Like, these basically have these monopolies. And to think that Twitter, because someone launched a new app, is just going to go down and everyone's going to change their behavior, it's just not really what we've seen. You know, at Uber, like, Uber also is very much a network marketplace-based company. And what you had was Lyft and Uber just started paying people a ton of money to switch, you know. And I think we saw that with Blur as well. Like, they were able to kind of get rid of OpenSea's monopoly and dominance, but they also cut out royalties, which was 6%, didn't charge a marketplace fee. So they effectively made trading 7 to 8% cheaper, like, which is just a massive amount of money. And I feel like those financial incentives are like one of the few things we've seen even like grade away at marketplace monopolies. But here, it just never made sense to me that people thought there was any chance that you'd see kind of a overnight change in consumer behavior. As far as what Dalton's saying about Whale Swoosh or Wally Swoosh or Cy Whale, I'm not sure how you pronounce your name, but you know, one of the most prolific Twitter kind of threaders, and he tweets something like 300 to 400 times a day because he responds to a lot of his comments and is kind of everything that you, Twitter would want a high frequency user to do. You know, it was just announced that he made $2,000, but he was doing that stuff naturally because he wanted to build his audience. And I just generally think, like, when you start paying people to do things they were already doing, you introduce bots, you introduce fraud, you introduce so many different pieces that change the user experience. And again, I saw this at Uber a lot. Like, once we started paying people too much money to do refer people, do other things, like, that was when the bots started taking over and the normal user experience started to suffer. So I'm always skeptical when I start seeing people monetize things that don't need to be monetized based on the proof that millions of people are doing it without the monetization. That always makes me nervous. But yeah, that's a lot of rambling on two different topics you just discussed.
Well, I think that actually the tie is that Threads will never beat Twitter, and Twitter will just slowly die. Like, is that what that means? It just means we're SOL, I mean, right?
I've devoted so much of my time to building out a presence on Twitter, right? Like, it's something that is I've really focused on. I devote a lot of time to. So, I do think the platform feels unstable right now. Like, I do worry, you know, I remember when Ryan Selkis, you know, big kind of crypto influencer and the CEO of Messari just got kicked off for 4 days and didn't know why. You know, like, these are people's real livelihoods and careers and passions that right now feel less stable. And it does feel like there's a lot of impulsiveness that kind of goes on with Elon's leadership and decision-making, where it is, as someone who really cares about that platform, I find it a little unstable. So I'm not like a Twitter maxi or anything. I just, at the same time, I've put too much work into there to leave, you know?
Yeah, same. And I think that it's going to be an interesting sort of transition as Twitter tries to figure it out. But I do think that, you know, I was on Threads for a couple of days. I liked it. You know, it was really cool. It was awesome to get that much engagement. But then I realized, like, if I wanted to actually go and find stuff, like, it was impossible. And there's no algo that allows me to, like, you know, if I keep following these certain people, I will see these certain people. For whatever reason, Tom Brady's popping up in my feed, and I'm like, that's the last thing that I want to see, right? I don't want ads. So it wasn't an ideal experience for me. So I hope Twitter can figure it out. You know, speaking of Twitter, another really amazing, you know, creator that has done a lot on Twitter, with their work with Rug Radio and, you know, their Project Rec guy, you know, Sam, you talked to OSF. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your artist spotlight?
Yeah, I mean, when we do these artist spotlights right now, we're trying to do them in 25 minutes. And if you are going to give me a challenge that I find incredibly difficult, it is to talk to OSF for just 25 minutes. I mean, this guy is an artist who has double-digit one-on-one sales, even higher. He is a trader. You know, he worked at Barclays on a trading floor and as a bond trader. And I'd say probably one of the has a macroeconomics perspective that the space truly respects. He had the very famous sale of more than 70 apes that he sold into Blur Bids at the Pico Top, and that's super interesting. He's the artist behind Rec Guy, and they're starting Rec Guy. He has DGen's Finance. I mean, I could go on for a long time about kind of the way that OSF wears so many different hats in this space. So, you know, just getting to talk to him and try to ask about those things and as quickly as we could was a ton of fun. And yeah, always has interesting, thoughtful responses. So I hope you guys, hope everyone who listens enjoys hearing from him. Osif, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've talked many times in informal context, but it's nice to have you here. I mean, when I think of you, I just think of probably the most well-rounded, all-encompassing person in NFTs, both as an artist, and you have your own PFP project, and you are a trader and collector, and you are basically the macro economist of the space. How do you tell your story? What's your kind of 1-2 minute version of who you are and how you got here?
Oh, you give me a lot of flowers there. I don't know if all of them are true or not, but yeah, look, I used to be a trader at an investment bank. That was what my career was. I spent 10 years doing that. And prior to that, I spent my teenage years creating digital art, like taught myself how to code. And I was basically an internet degen 10 years too early. But in 2021, I finally got myself convinced to buy Bitcoin, then I bought Ether, then stumbled onto NFTs, and you know, I started out collecting, flipping, trading NFTs, just like a lot of people in 2021. Then I, you know, that moment hit for me where I started really believing in it, and started collecting a few different things to hold for longer term trades and theses. And then, you know, at the end of 2021, I thought I'd try my hand at drawing and creating art again, which I hadn't done for about 15 years. And I just put a one of one out there. Someone bought it. Put a new piece out there. Someone paid a little bit more for it. And, you know, from then on, each week it kind of seemed to have the right trajectory and take off a little bit. And so, you know, I spend most of my time now probably on the creation side of things, I think, but you know, still very much involved in buying and selling NFTs and creating crypto, etc.
Just hearing you kind of makes me wonder, what's it like? What's it like, that moment? I think everyone thinks, I have this piece I'd like to, maybe not everybody, but has some form of art that they're into or photography or whatever, and thinks, what would it be like to just put a piece out and see what happens? I mean, you have that experience. You've seen it go from one to many. What was that experience for you?
It's very daunting, I think, especially in this day and age when, you know, compared to when I created digital art 15 years ago, there was stuff out there, but it wasn't like amazing. Whereas now, with all the tools that you can use, people create, and AI, of course, people can really create really, really amazing pieces. And you just, when you put something out there, it's very daunting. And your immediate reaction is like, maybe the first time you might sing in front of a crowd, they're like, you're just like, what will people think of me? This feels stupid. Like, maybe this is dumb. So I think when I did it with zero expectations. I didn't even really market it. I think I just like posted a link to the foundation auction and had one tweet, and that was it. Because I was like, you know what? I don't really want to like hype this. I don't really want to talk about it because I'm not feeling very confident over it. And I still don't really feel confident over my art even now. And I still have that same feeling when I put something new out or try to sell something or put it on auction or whatever. So yeah, it's a very daunting feeling. And you do have to push yourself outside the comfort zone, but I'm glad I did, you know, glad I made that step. And if anyone has that thought or was wondering or was sitting on the edge of the fence, I would highly recommend it.
One thing I ask a lot of artists, and I'm curious about for you, is was there a moment where, I mean, your work now sells for double digits and more? You have editions that have sold for double digits. One of ones, you know, are going very well. Was there a moment that kind of bumped you over that edge where suddenly you went from being someone who was one of many artists on a platform to one of the artists who people really found collectible?
Yeah, I think it was the first... A one of one that I created. It was called Professional DJ, and it was a piece on Foundation. And I think it was the first piece I had where it was like computer screens and like, you know, like looks rare on one screen and OpenSea on another screen, all these different screens and stuff, and a bunch of DJs sitting there kind of like trying to trade it. I think it was like, that was the first. I have four different professional DJ pieces now, five actually. And that was the first one that I did. But I think it was the first one that people could actually like really resonate with. And that one of one actually, it sold for 6.9 ETH. So it wasn't like a double digit ETH sale, but I think my previous highest sale before that was one ETH or 1.5 ETH. But I think that was the first one where I had like lots of new bidders come in to try and win it. People, for whatever reason, really resonated with that. And after that one was when I got accepted to Super Rare. And then, you know, back in the day, back then, you know, if you're on a Super Rare, you suddenly add another 40-50% to your premium because people wanted to collect your first Super Genesis. So that was the real transition period for me, when it went from just being, you know, a single digit ETH selling artist to double digits.
And what do you think was like the recipe there? I mean, what comes to mind for me is a piece of art that people identified with, that, you know, a lot of times that perhaps saw themselves in and kind of mocked a little bit the world that we're all living in, combined with, I imagine you had a pretty good distribution, a good Twitter following. I mean, clearly not what you have now, but at least some sort of distribution that people already knew your reputation. But what would you kind of attribute that jump up to?
Yeah, it's a lot of different things. I think, look, I did, I had started accruing a large Twitter following at that point in time, mainly from collecting things and trading things, etc. That definitely helped. It helped to have a good audience. I think people feel more confident in investing their ETH into someone who has a good audience. But you know, I also probably had the audience for at least 2 or 3 months before from the other pieces I was making. So I think with this one, I just captured a moment in time that everyone could resonate with. And you know, there's all sorts of things going on in crypto we've been through a lot in the last 12 to 18 months. And so I feel like when you capture a moment where everyone's like, oh my God, like I just like get this or understand this, that it can be very, very powerful. And those are the moments where I've had the most success. And whether it was with that piece, whether it was when I think my highest sell was Professional DJ M4, so it's a similar thing. Rex Guy is another thing which just captured this moment in time. It's those are the things that I think that's when you can really hit something powerful. And that's not just like true for me. That's true for art in general, and not just NFTs. It's true for art and culture over the last few centuries. It's like, you know, what can you create something that everyone can, a large amount of people can really identify and really feel? And that's when I think you can have something special.
I guess that kind of fits into a broader question of what your goal is with the art. It feels like there's a glitch kind of theme that goes through it. You got ghosts in the work, zombie, you know, you have a lot of the themes that we see pretty frequently, but what are your goals with your art? Like what do you think is the bigger message and how it all fits together?
Yeah, I think the original goal was I just wanted to create some stuff and put it out there and find people who could like it, who would like it or resonate with it. And that goal hasn't really changed. Like, you know, sometimes you, when you get a bit of success, then you're what you start to put a bit of pressure on yourself. And then you're like, well, should I create this? Because I think people will like this rather than creating something that I want, that I like, or I feel like creating. So my main goal is like, I feel like I'm a creative person. And I really enjoy sitting on my iPad and drawing. And the main goal for me there is just to create stuff that I feel like creating, that either tells a story about myself or about crypto or about something, and put it out there and meet people who get it, you know. And I have a large group of collectors across editions, across one of ones, and you know, so I think some people maybe get me, some people get the art, some people get both. But when someone, you know, really gets what the art's about and resonates and understands what you were trying to put on that canvas, which maybe sometimes is not the most obvious thing, I think that feels really special. So, you know, that's happened to me a few times. It's happened to me on a couple of the one of ones that I've sold, and that really is a great feeling. So for me, it's always like chasing that feeling. It's like, can I put something out where it comes across as A to most people, but really I'm looking for someone who sees the B in it, and can I make that connection again with someone else? And for me, it's just, that's it for me, really. Like, and you know, it's not like, I know for it's a means of a living or an income for a lot of people, maybe it's a means of getting a big reputation and getting popularity, whatever it is. Like, for me, those things don't really interest me, and I don't feel like I need the art side of my life to like achieve certain goals and things like that that other people may need. And so for me, it really is just like a creative outlet and using it as a mechanism to connect with people who I think are on the same level as me in terms of the way they think.
So I'm just throwing one piece up here that I see as a bit more of a neutral one. This isn't one that like speaks about the degens of the world right now. What's your thinking when you with a piece like this? And I think of the golf hole one you put out recently, where it's kind of just a fun take on normal aspects of society. But what's the artist thinking when you decide to mint something like this?
Yeah. So for this, I think I must have come up with this maybe June 2022. May or June. And I think prior to that, I just created a lot of like stuff that was dark, that was rare, that was to do with markets crashing. And it was like very, very negative art, because that was just what we were going through at that time. And I was like, oh, maybe I've just become a bit too dark and negative with my art. So let me just create something that's a bit more fresh, happy and uplifting. So I'm really just into beverages and into like beverage brands. And I'm a big fan of Campari and Aperol Spritz. And you know, this idea of like taking an existing brand, changing the name slightly and putting it into my world happens a few times. And this is one of the cases in which it's happened. And, you know, a lot of the collectors, they love this piece. It's actually quite a popular piece within like the existing collectors. And it's become a bit of a meme where last summer we were all like drinking Aperol Spritzes and taking photos of it and sending to everyone and calling it Aperol Spritz. But the idea behind this one is it's meant to be like, hey, it's summer, have a nice, brightly colored, refreshing cocktail, and by the way, in the background you have green candles, so you know everything is happy and not so bad, and you can actually enjoy your life for a bit. And I think that for me, that's how I was feeling back then. I was like, man, I've just sat through 2 months of devastating price action, watching, you know, your net worth drop and watching all this money you have go down. It's like, why don't I just like take a break and actually enjoy the summer and you know, flip the narrative on its head a little bit. And I think that's what this piece entails.
Fair enough. No, it's awesome. And when I think of Europe, and London and the time I lived there, Aperol Spritz, on a weekend is certainly a memorable part of it. Now, this is kind of, what makes you the craziest artist in the history of NFTs in my world is that when this was one of the Red Light District drops, right? And yeah, just to give context, when you created Red Light District, you told the collectors that you would be giving the collectors of Red Light District a drop every single month until the day you die, which I think makes you there's lore around that. What were you thinking?
Yeah, so I made that piece, the Red Light District, and I really liked the way it came out. And at this point, I had no additions. I just had one of one. So it was going to be a one of one, but I liked it so much. I was like, well, why don't I make this an addition? Because I just felt like I wanted more people to have it and own it. So I made it an addition. It was an addition of 210. The mint price was 0.069. And believe it or not, it didn't sell out. I think I had like 70 or 80 of them left over. And I just ended up giving away loads to friends and family. Some people I probably don't even know they have what they have in their wallets right now. But originally it wasn't meant to give you a free airdrop. And what happened was I made another piece called Fuck Cash Grabs. And I wasn't even really going to mint it. I didn't really like the piece, but my brother-in-law really liked it. And he said, hey, you should sell this. This is a really good piece. I thought it wasn't good enough to sell, but why don't I just like make it a free airdrop for everyone who owns this Red Light District piece. So that's what I did. I made it a free airdrop and it went down really well. Like everyone really liked it. And what I noticed was the price of the airdrop, I think at the time was maybe like 0.25 ETH, and the price of the Red Light District was like 0.4 ETH. And I was like, wow, like, I was just giving these guys like a 60 or 70% return on the current price of the RLD. And I think at that point in time was the trader in me and like the finance dude in me was like, well, you know, what if I did that every month and you can have this kind of like dividend, like payment or piece of art or whatever you want to do with it, or we'll call it every month. So after that, I said, you know what, I'm going to do this every single month until I die. I'll create a new piece. It's going to be a free drop. And now it's a free claim. Back then it was a free airdrop and people can get it for free. So the second one was actually Professional Degen 3, which is a piece I think everyone really likes a lot. I think that one went down really well. I think this is a piece where, again, I think it's like a potentially like one of one quality piece. Yeah, it's that one right there. One of one quality piece that I decided just to make a free airdrop. And I think people are like, oh, he's actually not making some good stuff that's going to be free. But that was the point where like RLD really took off because people started doing the maths. And I just remember there was like one day where it just jumped from like 0.5 ETH to like 5 ETH in the space of a day, because you do a DCF on this art and you do the math and you realize that it's actually pretty good, depending on how patient you want to be.
Yeah. And very quick answer, one word, what is your burnout level right now on a 1-10 scale, having done call it 15 or 16 of these?
I would say 1-2. Like I love doing these. It's the best thing I do every month. I'm definitely not tired.
Let's go. Okay, so the till you die pledge is still fully intact.
Still fully intact, yeah. And if I die, it's good for the art, so it's win-win.
Yeah, exactly. We could, honestly, I feel like I could talk to you for an entire hour about your art, but I do want to talk a little bit about your kind of market views and and other things, but given, we only have a little bit of time. How, you've recently been tweeting a lot more bullishly about Bitcoin, about crypto in general. And I guess I kind of have two questions and they're sort of separate, but one is, given all the assets you've looked at in your life and traded and, worked at a professional trading desk, why is it that this is the asset class you ended up devoting your career to? Why don't we start with that?
Two things, volatility and upside. Like I went from trading fixed income and I traded high yield and distressed debt. Like that was a very, very volatile asset, but it doesn't even compare to how volatile crypto is. So at the end of the day, it's like, well, I'm going from something where I can make like 10, 20, 30. I mean, even in my job, you can make like 50, 60, 70% returns and stuff, to something where you can make 1,000 times your money. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, well, you're not going to catch the 1,000x's all the time, but that opportunity set is there. And it's something that, I feel confident in my trading and investing ability. So I want to be in that market where you have these big swings, because that's where I think you can really make a lot. And it's just so much more interesting. just so, so, so much more interesting.
The obvious flip side of that is you can lose 90% of your money, you know, when you wake up in the morning. Have you kind of wrestled with those demons at all?
Yeah, look, I've had, it's not all smooth sailing. Like I've had losses. Like having been a trader for 10 years, like I'm disciplined enough to take profits where and when I need to. And having changed my, you know, my life from having a job where I get paid a salary and a bonus to having no income, I was disciplined about taking enough money out. So my thing is like, look, as long as I have enough money to live for a runway that I'm comfortable with, and everything else is just like, cool, I can be risk on with it. And I know I'm going to get beaten up sometimes. And sometimes you do lose 80%, 90%. But I just feel like it's about being disciplined. And I've had 10 years of disciplined training, if you like, or just being in the weeds of doing it day in, day out. So it's something that I'm, you know, I have confidence in myself that I will have the discipline to stop out, take profits, run the right trades at the right time.
And in this space, it feels like without getting 1,000x, like being ahead of that is about knowing where public attention is going to shift. Like this is an attention game as opposed to like a cash flow game when you're investing in early stage stocks or startups. How do you look at it? You know, how do you get ahead of 1,000x trades? And kind of like, what are you sniffing for when you're finding those?
I think that is the beauty of this market. Those 1,000x trades, you nailed it. It's about trying to buy or identify the attention, and there's no model or calculation or anything that can identify that. So sometimes, and to be honest with you, a lot of the trading, even when I was at an investment bank, sometimes it's just feeling. It's just a gut feeling. It's like you see something, you see the reaction of people around it. You maybe have a good understand of memes, or you have a good understand of the history of NFTs, or you have a good understand of like how people think. And when certain things fall into place, you just know that it's going to be there. And look, there are some numbers to it. And you can look at, you know, for an ERC-20 token, you can maybe look at the number of holders and how fast that rate is, and look at like social media mentions and Twitter mentions. And there are all these different metrics you can look at to analyze that and help you get a build a score for it. But I think that's always half the battle. And the other half of the battle is this kind of finger in the air or gut instinct, or, you know, there's something special that you can't identify what it is, but you know you have that now from building this like indirect data for yourself over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. And that's why I think this is an amazing market, because you can come in and be able to identify that and not have any training in maths or finance or anything like, or any history or experience in it, and make a lot of money. And that's the most amazing thing I think about this market is.
I mean, one of the trades that I think you're most famous for is selling, you know, 77 Bored Apes to Machi, you know, kind of at peak Blur bull market, which lasted about 3 days after season two started. I also think that trade is often misunderstood. So I'd be curious from yourself, like what was your thinking behind that trade? Let's start with that.
Yeah, look, at that point, Manjo and I had held Apes for about 18 months, I think, probably about 18 months. And we were very bullish on them for a very long time. But, you know, at some point you have to exit your trade. And for us, we wanted to hold on to them because all the airdrops were worth so much. But we could see after the heavy metal one, it was like, well, look, this was still a good airdrop. It was still worth a lot. But you could see that like the attention was starting to drift. There was like, it was becoming something that was much bigger and quite complicated and hard to keep up with. And it just fell outside of our investment mandate, I think. And it was just such a big part of our portfolio. So I think we were already thinking about finding a way to exit it. But, you know, when you own that much and you start selling it, it's very difficult. And we just had all this liquidity on Blur. We just looked at it one day and we're like, wow, we could sell all our Apes for 72 ETH each, and we wouldn't even move the floor price. And so we started thinking about it. But over that week, the floor price actually rose from 72 to 78. So I think Mando sent me a text and was like, we should just sell these. And when are we ever going to have this liquidity? And for us at that moment in time, it was more a decision on let's take the liquidity while we have it, rather than us thinking the price would go down. And I could take all the credit here and say, we knew NFTs were going to crash. But honestly, to be honest with you, we did it because we had the liquidity to do it. And had we not had the liquidity, I wonder if we would have sold them. The answer is probably no, I think.
What do you think that would have looked like? Do you think you would have like just kind of gradually sold them here and there? Do you think you would have tried to just dump into a market that wasn't buying them? Like, what do you think that would have looked like had that not been there?
I think we would have gradually sold them. I think we would have listed two or three, tried to sell like, you know, two or a couple every week. I think we'd be very, you know, we know, I mean, we used to have massive risk positions back at investment banks where people knew your risk, and people, if word got out on the street that you were trying to sell it, everyone would front run you. So that's not a new position for us to be in, but I think we would have taken it slow. We'd have just been like, let's not dump these all in one go and create the floor price. Let's just get rid of a couple every week and, you know, have some offers out there. And if you get listings, et cetera, and we had some good stuff and stuff that wasn't just floors. So, and back then mid tiers would trade. So I think we would have been able to do it, but it would have been a long process. It would have taken us a few months, I think.
For sure. And then the last question, I want to give you a chance, you know, just to give kind of the one to two minute pitch on Rec Guy. You know, PFPs have been so rough lately. You have a PFP collection that is yours, your art, you're the operator behind it. What's the pitch? Why should someone own a Rec Guy in this market?
PFPs are rough because the value of most PFPs were predicated on teams that had raised money to go out there and execute roadmaps. And to execute those roadmaps, it costs money. They had to then raise money, et cetera, and then it ended up that a lot of them failed. So NFTs, I think, will have a lot of value in the future. NFTs where the value doesn't derive from a roadmap, doesn't derive from having to raise capital, doesn't derive from a team's ability to go out there and execute certain things. And that's exactly what Rec Guy is. Like, it is just, we never had a roadmap. It was a free mint, and it was just a moment in time that captured the zeitgeist. But by the way, like, the idea of getting wrecked is evergreen within crypto. We're still here 18 months on, and Bitcoin's up 85% and people still feel wrecked, right? So I think that the idea of being wrecked is engraved within crypto culture, and that's a collection, one of the only collections, I think, and you maybe have Goblin Town as well, but that really captures that idea. And that's where the value comes from. The value hasn't come from us raising capital and going out there and saying we're building a P2E game. The value comes from people just recognizing and understanding and resonating with the art, the culture, and the ideologies behind that. And those ideologies will always, always, always be there in crypto. And that's the pitch. That's the pitch. Like, you own it because you resonate with it. And I think there are more than 8,814 people out there who will resonate with that as time goes on. And it's something that's tied to me and tied to Manda. And I hope we've demonstrated that we're going to be here the whole time. And we for its you know, plus points and negative points, we do love the space, and we love showing up every day, and we always will be here. So that's kind of like a, if you support us, you buy a Rec Guy, but just because, just to show some support, and that's another reason as well.
It's awesome. Yeah, there's a bit of that connection to both of you, as well as that meme factor that people identify with. Makes sense. Last thing, 30 seconds. Your Twitter has gotten more bullish on the space. What makes you bullish right now?
I think sentiment has been max bearish for a while. It's very bearish, but more importantly, from a macro standpoint, you are now having light at the end of the tunnel. Like, US inflation has dropped from 9.7% to 3%. We're 1% above the Federal Reserve's target. Just, you know, think about that for a second. It's a huge change. The economy isn't in a recession. It's the other way around. The labor market's strong, the economy's strong. So, you know, the Fed seems to have pulled out this like weird soft landing scenario that everyone is now thinking about. And you've had a huge rally in macro assets, and crypto has lagged for whatever reason it has. NFTs have had a tough time, but you're just at this moment in time where you can see the wind is changing. Like, we're not where we were last year, and most bear markets last for 1 year. We've been in one for about 18 months. So there's a lot of things in your favor right now. There's a lot of things to look forward to. You have the Fed potentially cutting rates, but I don't think it'll be this year anymore, but probably at some point towards the end of next year. You have these two of three of the world's largest asset managers filing for Bitcoin ETFs. They don't do that unless they think they have a high probability of success, and if they have a lot of demand for it. And as soon as they start doing it, other people will start doing it as well. So there are like clear positive catalysts. There's clear data to show that the tide is turning. And price action has showed it to an extent. Like, Bitcoin is up 85% this year, but we're also still down 50% from the highs. And if you are here, you probably believe in the technology and the culture and the ideas, at least to some extent. You might not be a full on believer, but you believe to some extent. So it is just, I think it's an amazing opportunity to own risk, buy risk, and be long for what I do really believe is the start of the next bull cycle. I really, really do believe that.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much. The mandate was 25 minutes, 26 minutes is what we did. I think that's good enough, but awesome to have you. One of the best artists, commentators, traders, all that jazz in the game. We really appreciate you hopping on here.
Appreciate it. Cheers, Sam.
Amazing. What a great interview. OSF with that accent just always sounds smarter no matter what he says. And I believe it all. So great job, Sam. Great job, OSF. And really thanks especially to our special, special guest, Carly Riley. Do you want to tell us everything about the next OPJ LA event that's coming up?
I do. I'm having sound issues but okay, I think I've solved them.
Let's go.
Yes. So I have been on a national tour. It has been so fun going. This will be our fifth event, our second time in Los Angeles. Our first time we were joined by Proof's one and only Kevin Rose. And I will be back in Los Angeles on July 25th for another overpriced happy hour event, open bar, good light bites, and great conversation. I will be joined by Steven Teglis, who is the CEO of Cool Cats, and by Klon, the artist behind Cool Cats. The Cool Cats team is one I wanted to interview for some time now, just to look retrospectively at like what happened with Cool Cats, where they are now, etc. And Cool Cats holders can now come and join us there. Dead Fellas holders can also join us because the event was initially going to be with Betty, and then she had to be back in Australia. La da da. OPJ NFT holders can also join us. So anyways, go to opjtour.com, reserve your seats, and we'll see everyone there.
That sounds so exciting. That's awesome.
And y'all are invited, of course, as always.
Yeah, I might try to hop in.
All our LA-based Proof folks.
Let's go. Yeah. Let's go. So another big thanks to Dalton. Great first round. You did well. So we're happy to see you. Hopefully we'll have you back on and we'll get you to talk about you. NFT finance at some point.
Let's go.
be sure to catch us every Friday live at 100 Proof here at 10 a.m. Pacific. And join in on the conversation in the chat. We love hearing from you guys. And another plug, actually, for now that we have Sam and Dalton here, we do a weekly show on Thursdays in the Discord called Market Talk. That's always a lot of fun. So it's just really nice to have you guys both back here and vibe. So thank you all so much for joining us and for hanging out with us. Next week, I believe Kevin will be back. Boo. Yay. Just kidding. We'll get right back to the regularly scheduled programming. But we had a great time this week. Thank you so much. We'll see you soon.